or maybe he didn't say exactly, but he asked me to talk about something late last week. So this is the result of a frantic weekend's worth of work, so moderate your expectations, is what I'm trying to say. So the title of the talk is A Leisurely Stroll Through TLFTs, Topological Lattice Field Theories, and How They May Be Useful in Quantum Computation. So why a leisurely stroll? Well, partly because my understanding of TLFTs is I think, pretty elementary and basic. And I also don't really know too much about the background of the audience. And I know there are people at PI that understand quantum gravity and probably know everything there is to know about lattice field theories, but maybe not all of you do that. So maybe I can start with some basics. So again, my name is Gorian Alagish. I'm a postdoc at IQC in the CNO department at Waterloo. Also, some other people that are thinking about this stuff, Alex Russell at UConn, Chris Moore at the University of New Mexico and Santa Fe Institute, John Yard at LAML, Seth Landau at CUNY, there's some others too. So I want to start with on a very basic level, just to talk about knots. So here's a knot, or I guess more accurately, this is a knot diagram. Because a knot is something that exists in free space, and a knot diagram, of course, is what happens when we project the knot into the plane and mark the under and over crossings in some sort of sensible way. You can also think about link diagrams. So links are just like knots, except you have a vertical strand. And so if our theory of diagrams is to make sense, we should be able to do some manipulations on them, like, for example, this one here, where I twisted this loop. Because after all, we can certainly do this manipulation upstairs in the topology, so we should be able to represent that in our diagram too. So this is true. This is called the type 1 Rademeister move, as I'm sure you all know. And in this particular case, it turns out that if we undo this kink, we get the right-handed trefoil knot. Okay, so that's just some non-trivial knot. So in fact, there are three of these Rademeister moves. Most of you know this, all of you know this probably. The first one I already talked about. The second one is just one where you can pull one strand over another. And the third one is where you can pull a strand over another crossing. And you can apply inverses of these moves. So just the point that I would like to make is that these are purely combinatorial rules. And in fact, these diagrams are purely combinatorial objects. So this is a really nice situation because it allows us to pass from geometry to combinatorics and kind of work without worrying about the details of the geometry upstairs. And the reason, so I guess maybe I should say, why are these things combinatorial structures? Well, you can just imagine replacing these things by graphs, assigning a vertex for every crossing, maybe labeling them in some way so that you know which one is an undercrossing and which one is an overcrossing, and then all of these, these edges over here are really just edges of a graph. And then you can imagine performing these manipulations on graphs, which is really what we do. And the reason this whole idea makes sense and is really natural is because of this theorem by Alexander and Briggs and independently Rademeister in 1927, which says that any two diagrams of the same link differ by a finite number of these moves.
Yes, sir. Maybe it's a naive question, but when you say you can convert these into graphs. I mean, you can draw graphs in the plane differently. Like you could imagine there are two things that are the same graph, two different drawings, and you're saying it would correspond to the same knot.
Yeah, well, you would have to. So first of all, you can't have, this thing here can't be an edge. You have to split it and put a vertex here. And then you have to label things in some natural way that tells you, which edges are up and which ones are below.
It's clear that the knots then correspond to sort of the planar embeddings of graphs. But then, you may be able to draw a graph in a radically different way in the plane, and then is the knot still preserved?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, yes. If you don't create any crossings, right, that's just a homeomorphism in the plane, which is also going to give you a homeomorphism in the free space. Yes.
Right.
Not a unique one.
So the reason this all makes sense is because of this theorem, and obviously, it's relatively obvious sort of that these moves are all legal, right? So if I do this, do any of these moves to a diagram, it's pretty clear that the topology won't change. But it's not at all obvious that this is true. Right? It's not at all obvious that if I take this
question. What do you mean by diagrams of the same link? I mean, I didn't quite catch that.
Okay, well, I mean, so right, so there's a few sort of technical details you have to worry about. By same link, you might mean, you know, isotopic links. By two diagrams of the same link, you might mean, you know, take the same link and project it onto two different planes. Or you might mean take, you know, two isotopic links and project them both into a plane. So, I mean, any sort of, I mean, any two ways of producing a diagram from an isotopic family of links.
Good. So I guess I don't understand what a link is.
Okay, so a link is it's an embedding of a finite number of copies of S3 into R3.
S3, let's see.
S1?
S1, sorry. S1. Yes, yes, it's a finite. It's,
okay,
it's any way of embedding a finite number of circles into R3.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, there's some more technical details that you have to worry about there. But I mean, I'm just sort of taking the point of view that sort of all of those details can be worked out so that our intuition works. And they really can. So but there are some dynamics.
And when you say same, there is hidden
Yeah, so some kind of isomorphism is a hidden there, which is isotropy.
Okay.
Right. Since those kinds of technical details are exactly what you can sort of forget about when you pass to the diagram picture and start working with these things combinatorially. And again, you know, it's not just that you can change this combinatorial picture in a way that doesn't adjust topology; it's that sort of you can do it in a complete way. Okay, so this is a wonderful situation, and the question I'd like to talk about is if something analogous happens in higher dimensions.
Also, another question actually is this sort of is there an efficient algorithm? To get from one to the other.
I don't know, but I would imagine no. I mean, I guess that depends on what you mean, right? I mean, you would have to define efficient in some way based on some parameter in, terms of the number of crossings in either link, like the maximum number of crossings or whatever. So, that's a good question. I think
the answer is no.
That would be my guess, but I don't
know. I forget exactly what's known about it.
I think maybe for alternating links, but not for general.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's pretty close to like some kind of a graph. Isomorphism.
Yeah, maybe you could even embed graph isomorphisms. Okay, so what I'd like to talk about is what happens in if there's something analogous happening in higher dimensions, and thankfully the answer is yes. So let's talk about orientable surfaces first. So here's an example of the torus. So everyone knows you can cut the torus up like this if you want. Or alternatively, you can start with this sheet and glue you know, the red edges together and the blue edges together and get a torus out. So what I'd like to do is just cut this into two pieces and build a triangulation this way. So first, what I mean by a triangulation here, I mean a topological triangulation. So that means that my triangles are allowed to bend. And right, so you could imagine also a geometric kind of triangulation where you, let's say, embed the torus in R3, and then you want to, you know, triangulate it very finely with flat triangles so you can, you know, reproduce a picture on the computer. But that's sort of the opposite of what I'm interested in. I want a triangulation that just tells me what the topological structure of the surface is, so I'm interested in sort of the smallest number of triangles possible. So this is a perfect triangulation that just uses two edges to describe. So I should also say, so this is also a combinatorial structure here on the right, because all I need is a list of triangles, you know, with labeled edges, and then, you know, some description of which edges, you know, which labels go together, so that I know how to glue my triangles together. So again, this is some kind of graph. So the nice thing about links and link diagrams is that these things came equipped with legal moves, these Rademeister moves. So what are the legal moves on triangulations? So those are called the Pachner moves. So the first Pachner move is the Chu-Chu move, and it just says that you can take a pair of triangles, you can just take a pair of triangles like this anywhere in your triangulation and replace them with a pair of triangles like this by taking removing this edge and putting in an edge like this. And the 1-3 move says that you can take any one triangle in your triangulation and just draw three more edges like that to replace it with three triangles. And you can apply inverse with this too. And so just like with the Rademeister moves, there's a theorem, Pachner's theorem, from 91, which says that any two triangulations of the same surface differ by a finite number of these moves.
So orientability is not an issue here?
I'm sorry?
So there's, I mean, is orientability a requirement for this theorem?
You can do it for unorientable surfaces too. But I'm just going to worry about orientable ones to make things, because the triangulations are similar. Okay, so in fact, this is true for arbitrary dimensions. How does this work? Well, to sort of get some intuition for how this might work in arbitrary dimensions, let's look at a 2-2 move like this. Okay, so let's suppose that this is part of a triangulation of some surface, and let's say that we want to apply the 2-2 move to the leftmost two triangles. So I'm going to do that like this. I'm going to take a tetrahedron, and I'm going to stick it onto the triangulation so that two of its faces line up with the two triangles that I'm trying to transform, and then I'm going to sort of bump the triangulation out along the tetrahedron. So it's easy to see that now I've replaced it with two triangles, but the edge now goes the opposite way. And really what I've done here is I've cut the boundary of the tetrahedron into two contiguous pieces, and I've transformed the triangulation by mapping from one contiguous piece to the other. And it's easy to see that there's only one other way to cut the tetrahedron in that way, and that's to take one face as one part of the boundary, and the other three faces as the other part. So I can take, you know, so let's say the rightmost triangle of my triangulation, stick a tetrahedron on there, and bump it out into the repeat. So that's the one.
And you can do the reverse of that, I guess?
Yes, you can do the reverse. So you could pick three triangles on your triangulation, stick a tetrahedron up there, and replace it. So why does this give you some intuition about the n-dimensional case? Well, in n dimensions, you're going to be talking about triangulations into n simplices. Okay, so for two dimensions, it's triangles; for three dimensions, it's tetrahedra, and so on. And sort of the way that Pachner moves work in n dimensions is you take an n plus one simplex, just like this. You know, you cut it into two; you cut its boundary into two contiguous pieces. You stick that n plus one simplex onto your triangulation, matching up one of those parts, and then you transform to the other part. Basically, that's the idea. So, but the punchline is that, you know, this Pachner's theorem holds for any dimension. There's a finite number of these Pachner moves, no matter what n is, and if you take two triangulations of any n manifold, there's a finite number of moves from one to the other.
Is there a sense in which the case of knots are sort of low-dimensional analogs of this, or is it
different? I don't really know how. I mean, maybe there is, but I don't really see a way to think about that. I mean, you can look at the sort of one-dimensional version of this. But the one-dimensional version is sort of silly. It just says, you know, you can transform, you can transform along a triangle. So you can map an edge to two edges, mm-hmm. or two edges to one edge. Mm-hmm. But I don't really see what that has to do. Not. Okay, so this is wonderful. We have a nice way to replace topological objects with combinatorial ones, and we have these theorems that tell us that this is sort of structure preserving in some way. So I claim that to see sort of what this is good for, we should add in some algebra. So far we've replaced topology with combinatorics, and we've figured out what the legal moves are. So the next step will be to find tensors, so some kind of algebraic object, which I'll describe in a minute, which satisfy these legal moves. And then we're going to decorate our triangulations with these tensors, and that will basically be it. So this is good for a lot of things for physicists. I guess it is good for a lot of things, although I don't know too much about that. But we'll just focus on the fact that this gives us topological invariance. And the reason that it gives us topological invariance is because, you know, we started with a topological structure. We replaced it with a combinatorial structure so that we know what the legal moves are. And then we put an algebraic structure on top of that, but we made sure that the legal moves are satisfied. So that will ensure that this algebraic object we get in the end will be invariant, topological invariant. Okay, so let me talk about tensors for a little bit so that we know what we're talking about. Okay, so tensors are just a really nice way to do multilinear algebra. So let's pick a Hilbert space V once and for all. So here's what an LK tensor looks like. So it's an element of L tensor power of the Lth tensor power of V tensor the Kth tensor power of V star. Just some number of copies of V, some number of copies of V star. And we say that T has contravariant rank L and covariant rank K. And that's just fancy language for describing how many copies of V and how many copies of V star there is. So now if you had a basis for V, we could write out T in this basis and get a bunch of these coefficients. But I think that we can actually use this kind of symbol, this kind of notation, to work with tensors in a basis-independent way. So how will that work? Well, it'll take maybe some examples to see this, but let me just say that we'll denote any tensor by a capital letter, like T, and then a bunch of lowercase indices, some upstairs and some downstairs. Each index will be unique, and it will refer to a particular copy of V. So I1 here refers to the first copy of V, IL refers to the last copy of V, you know, J1, J2 refer to the first two copies of V star, and so on. And if we follow some basic conventions, which I'll talk about in a minute, we can use this notation in a basis independent way. Even though it kind of seems weird right now, if you haven't seen it before, it looks like we're just mixing basis dependence and basis independence, but it turns out we can make it work, and it actually is actually a really nice way to think about these multilinear maps. So there's two operations that we can perform on tensors. So I'll just give you the sort of the rough general definition of what they are, and then I'll do some examples after that that I think will clear them up. So first we can do the tensor product. So that one's relatively easy. So you can imagine, you know, T is an element of this space, and R is an element of something that looks just like this, but maybe has n copies of V here and n copies of K here. We can take the tensor product of those two huge spaces, right? And then T and R will just be a tensor that lies in that big tensor product. So notice now we have L plus n many indices upstairs and K plus n many indices downstairs. So that really means that the resulting tensor is an element of, you know, B to the L plus n power tensor B star to the K plus n. So the other operation is it's a little more complicated, and maybe some examples would be necessary to see exactly what it does, and it's called contraction. So we start just like we did with the tensor product. So assume that all of these indices up here, all these dots, are distinct indices, just like up here. But there's one index that we're going to repeat. Okay? So there's an index I that shows up in T upstairs and an index I that shows up in R downstairs. And so I promised you that every distinct index refers to a particular copy of V. And that's still true here. So the interesting thing about, you know, forming this sort of this contraction of these tensors is that I, you know, there's one index in this tensor that refers to the same copy of V that this tensor refers to in this index. The only difference is that T refers to it contravariantly and R refers to it covariantly. So what we're really doing is we're taking the tensor product of T and R, but we're no longer taking it over two independent vector spaces. There's a particular copy of V, right, where T acts contravariantly and R acts covariantly. Okay, so if we take the tensor product there, really we're taking the inner product in that particular copy of V. Okay, so there's actually an implicit summation right here if you want to think about it in a basis dependent way. So I'll do some examples in a second there. We'll clear that up. Okay, but the result, in any case, is an L plus M minus 1 and K plus M minus 1 tensor. because we've contracted this index away, and so we just let have, you know, L plus n minus 1 copies of V and K plus n minus 1 copies of V stuff left. So let me do some examples. So here are some basic example tensors. So a vector might be denoted V super I. So it has one index upstairs that tells you it's an element of V. A dual vector you might denote by U sub J. So it has one index downstairs, so it's an element of V star. A linear operator, we know, is an element of V tensor V star. So it should have one unique index downstairs and one unique index upstairs. We can also form the inner product by contraction of a vector and a dual vector. So here we're taking the inner product of the vector U super I with the dual vector V sub I. And now notice that it's really important that I use the same index for U and for V, because I want them to refer to the same vector space. And if I had different indices, then the result would be an element of V tensor V star. It would be an outer product. So the fact that I'm using the same index means that I'm taking the inner product. I'm addressing the same vector space. So in Brockett notation, this is denoted by just the order in which you put those prosecutions. But here it's denoted by. So applying an operator to a vector, well, it's just aij vi. And if you write that out in the basis, it's easy to see. You know, what's the entry of A applied to B? It's sum over I aij vi. Okay. Matrix product, the same thing. What's the ikth entry of A times B? Well, it's sum over j aij jk. And Hilbert Schmidt norms.
Should be the square root.
I'm sorry? Oh, right, yes. Right, square root. Square root.
So
this is the trace of A times A dagger. Yes, right?
Are these real vector spaces?
No, they're complex vector spaces. They're Hilbert
spaces. So where is the complex conjugation in the Hilbert Schmidt norm?
Well, I mean, it's implicit. If I take the dual of a vector, I mean the dual, right? Complex conjugate dual.
But is it in the... I don't see it. And it just looks.
So A sub J super I.
It's just like the trace of A super I.
Well, A sub J super I is the adjunct. Because we're not looking at, right, when I say V star, I don't mean just the vector space dual, I mean the Hilbert space dual.
Yeah, but then how would you write, say, the product of the two matrices?
I'm sorry, how
would you write the trace of a matrix then?
The trace of a matrix?
I mean of a tensor.
I'm sorry, the trace of
it. The trace of a tensor.
The trace of a tensor.
The operation on the tensor that corresponds to the trace of the matrix.
So
contractions are like traces.
Yeah, I mean the contraction of the trace. So I would write.
I'm having trouble seeing the difference between that and the trace of A squared.
Make
the two I's a different index.
The inner product with a constant matrix.
Constant
tensor. You could take its contraction with a particular tensor.
Right.
The trace of a matrix is basically its Hilbert Schmidt in a product.
Right.
Maybe a related question. The matrix product that you've written there is then really kind of a dagger B.
So that's like the matrix. Yeah. So that's like the matrix product of A and B dagger.
A and B dagger. Okay. If you wanted to write AP, you'd have to do what F instead. You'd have A with lower I, lower J, or and then a constant.
Right. You would have to put in. You would have to insert like the identity matrix.
Yeah. Okay.
Any more questions?
I'm still confused on this, but go on.
Okay. Okay, so tensor networks are just a pictorial way of thinking about tensors and thinking products of tensors. So,
well, here's the example. Yeah. So that this is really A times B dagger.
Yeah, right. So this is the right. You're right. So this is the product of A and B dagger, the matrix product of A and B dagger, and this is the trace of the product of A with B dagger.
It's still kind of confusing. How do you know it's A times B dagger and
not A dagger?
A dagger times B.
Exactly.
Well, it depends on. Well, I guess you have to, I mean, if you have some particular matrix in mind that you want your tensor to represent, you have to decide what that matrix is. I mean, either it's A or it's A dagger. So then if A sub I super J represents A, right, then A sub J super I is A dagger. Does that make sense?
Not really. I mean, the I and J, therefore, are more than just on the indices.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
I think there are two functions, right? And yes. They identify both the Hilbert space and where they're placed identifies whether it's the dual,
right,
it's a dual space or
right. If they're upstairs and downstairs or close to.
No, sure, that's not a problem. I mean, I guess the reason that Raphael and I and probably other people in the room are confused is this is subtly different from the way physicists usually use this tensor notation.
Okay.
Just on this,
I guess
so we're happy with the low and the upper case, that's right. Fine. We're happy with the summation notation, that's fine.
Okay.
But, I can't quite put my finger up. I mean, this adjoint thing would not come up, so.
The notation I've seen is different, but I'm not saying this is not a consistent notation, so I don't understand it.
Yeah.
The notation I've seen, you have an explicit tensor, you have another kind of index for the complex conjugate tensor.
Okay.
And you have an explicit tensor for
the... like a raising and a lowering operator? Is that what you mean?
Well, it could raise and lower, but it also changes the kind of index. This is
the
notation people use in relativity all the time.
Right.
Yeah. I think
this is the same. I don't think there's a conflict of notation, but maybe you should... Maybe we should go on.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that relativity, it's always real. Okay.
I mean, hopefully it's not so confusing that you can't make sense of what I'm trying to say. So tensor networks. So how do we build tensor networks? Well, each tensor is going to be replaced by a vertex, and I'm going to have an incoming edge for every contravariant index and an outgoing edge for every covariant index. And then to take the tensor product of two tensors, I'm just going to put these two widgets side by side with different labels for everything. And if I want to do a contraction, then I'll identify some of the labels on the edges and I'll connect them up. So in this case here, the product of S A and B dagger. And here's the trace of the product.
So without harping on this, but if you reverse the direction, the order of A and B, does it become the product of B with A dagger then somehow?
No, reversing the order shouldn't matter. I mean, you mean the product?
Yeah.
Reversing the order shouldn't matter.
So I don't...
It's a convention. You can either point your arrows towards the covariant or towards the contravariant.
No, not the arrows. I meant just if you wrote B... if you reverse the index I and J in those expressions, would that be something?
If you reverse the index...
You wrote A, I, J, B, J, I.
B, J, K. Oh, you mean
that?
No, okay.
In the trace of the product.
Okay.
If you just switched I and J, would that change anything?
If I just switched I and J?
Yeah, wrote it as A, J, I, B...
I mean, that just sounds like a change in notation to me. I don't know.
No, that would be the complex conjugate of everything, right?
That's why we're confused.
That's the confusion.
Right. Well, I think to take the complex conjugate of an operator, you have to apply like a raising and a lowering tensor.
The arrows would from here. If you have taken me the upper convention, then.
Oh, that's, oh, let's leave it. Let's leave it for later.
Okay, I think we're just somehow miscommunicating, but we should definitely work it out afterwards. So we all know what we're talking about. Okay, so two easy facts about tensor networks. Every network is actually a single tensor, right? Because we imagine contracting together all of the indices that appear inside the graph, and all the loose edges that are not attached at one end are just the remaining indices with this tensor. Right? So the fact that J, you know, is attached on both ends just means that it appears upstairs in some tensor and downstairs in some other tensors, which could be similar. And for the same reason, a network with no loose edges corresponds to a single number, because every index is going to be contracted. And here I just wrote out a basis, sort of a way to compute this quantity using a particular basis. You just label every edge with a basis vector. You note that that identifies, you know, each tensor with a complex number. It's like looking up the entry of the matrix in that particular basis. You multiply all these numbers together, and you sum over all the possibilities. And this is just called the contraction or the value of the network. Okay, so I promised that we would decorate our triangulations with tensors. So this is how we're going to do that. We're going to start with a triangulation, and then we're going to blow it up, just separate out the triangles, but remember how they're glued together. I'm going to label each edge with an index. Okay, and then I'm going to assign some three tensor to every face. And I'll just call it the spatial tensor. And notice that the indices of the tensor correspond to the indices for every edge. And then I'm going to throw in the gluing to tensor to glue the edges together. And so here, the indices of this gluing tensor just correspond to the indices that I assign to these edges that I'm going to glue together. So this is a tensor network. The tensors are, you know, the three tensors, one for every face, and the two tensors, one for every pair of edges that are being glued together.
So how should I interpret these repeated indices? Like, you know, there's an, should that be a K? Sorry, this A in the bottom triangle.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, this should be a K. Yes, that's a mistake. This should be a K. So what are the tensors in the network? There are the three tensor for every face and the two tensor for every pair of glued edges. And that's the tensor network. And so we want this theory to be topological. We want it to, you know, be an invariant. So we're going to require that the tensors satisfy the Tucker rules. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next slide. So the definition of a two-dimensional topological lattice field theory is just a choice of three tensor and a two tensor, which satisfy the 2-2 and 1-3 parameters. So TLFT is just a way of assigning tensors to triangulations in a way that's sort of topologically invariant.
I don't understand what it means for a tensor to satisfy partners.
Yeah, I'll talk about that right now. But I mean, so what have we done here? Right? We've shown how to start with a triangulation and turn it into a tensor. The tensor that corresponds to that network. So, you know, you can imagine, you know, the left side of the 2-2 Pockner move is just a triangulation of some kind. So you can write down the tensor that corresponds to it. And the right-hand side of the Pockner move is also some triangulation. You can write down the network that corresponds to it. And I guess it's important to imagine that this thing is sitting inside a bigger network, right? So that your labelings are all consistent. It's not like one is just a rotation of the other. So to make these networks look a little prettier, so there's not a bunch of tensors all over the place, I've defined this M sub AB super C, which is just a contraction of a face tensor, a spatial tensor, and a gluing tensor. So if you write out what the Pockner move means in what the 2-2 Pockner move means in tensors, it says this. And you can think about this as saying, you know, I'm going to take A and B and put it into C and then right multiply by E. Or I'm going to start with B and E and then left multiply that by A. And in either case, put the result into F. And this looks exactly like associativity, so you know what's going on. So what's going on is this really is associativity, because you can think about this tensor, M sub AB super C, so that's a 2-1 tensor. So it's an element of, you know, V tensor V tensor V star. So it's a map from V tensor V to itself, to V, sorry. It's a multiplication on the base vector space that we started with. So it makes V into an algebra, and this equation up here just says that it satisfies the 2-2 move if and only if this algebra is in fact associated. So it takes more work and a few more pictures, but you can actually show that the 1-3 move and satisfying it is equivalent to the statement that this algebra is in fact satisfied. It's a direct sum of simple modules.
Is that supposed to be obvious, or is that?
No, it's not obvious. This fact here, no, it's not obvious.
And what's a semi-simple algebra?
So a semi-simple algebra is an algebra which is, as a module over itself, it's a direct sum of simple modules. And simple modules are just irreducible ones you can't break down. So it's like a loop. Yeah, this fact is not obvious at all. In fact, you have to combine the 2-2 and 1-3 move into this other move called the bubble move, and then you have to do some. I mean, it's not too bad. Okay, so the theorem of Fukuma, Hosono, and Kawai in 92 just, you know, states this fact, which is that two-dimensional topological lattice field theories are in one-to-one correspondence with semi-simple associative algebras. So you could start, you know, you could start with your favorite semi-simple associative algebra. You could take the multiplication operator on that algebra, and, you know, that gives you a TLFT just by decorating the triangulations with those tensors.
Can I see the last slide? Sorry, I just couldn't see the last slide.
This slide?
Yeah, so what is V? Sorry.
V?
Yeah.
Oh, V is the vector space that all of these tensors are over.
Okay.
Okay, so what associative semi-simple algebras do we know? Well, I know group algebras. So what's a group algebra? So group algebra is just the space of all maps from a finite group to the complex numbers. You can define algebra multiplication on it just by taking convolution of functions. So this is a vector space of dimension order G. It's an algebra with this multiplication. It's associative because G is associative, and you've just linearized multiplication by G, and you can prove that it's simple. So what are the simple modules of the group algebra? They're the so-called irreducible representations of G. I'll just do one slide about representations. So what's a representation of G of a finite group? It's just an action of the group on a vector space. So what does it really do? It just associates to every group element some matrix in a homomorphic way. So the classical example is symmetric groups represented as permutation matrices. Okay, because elements of the symmetric group are just permutations of n letters, so you can think about the vector space spanned by those letters, and then the group elements act by permuting those basis elements. And that gives you permutation matrices. So then you can notice that the all ones vector is fixed by any permutation, obviously. So that gives an invariant, actually a fixed subspace of this action. And then it also turns out that its orthogonal complement is also an invariant subspace of this action. And so really what I've described to you here is a direct sum decomposition of this representation into irreducible representations, into representations that you can't break down any further. Call those derivatives. And the nice fact is that for finite groups and for complex vector spaces, you can do this. You can always do this. You can always take any representation and break it up into irreducibles. So now CG is also a representation of the group, of G. How does G act on CG? So let F be an element of CG, so it's some function from G to C. So an element X is going to act just by multiplying by X inverse inside. So you can check that this makes CG into a representation of G. It's called the left regular representation. And like any other representation, it has to break up into a direct sum of irreducibles. And it turns out what's very nice In fact, every era of G appears in this in the direct sum decomposition of CG, and it appears exactly its dimension.
What kind of objects are X, F, and Y?
Sorry, so X is an element of the group, okay. Y is an element of the group, and F is a function from the group to the complex numbers.
Okay.
So I'm saying this function, X, sorry?
The vector space is CG itself, you say?
Right.
Okay.
So how does a group element act on an element of that vector space? Well, an element of the vector space is just a function.
Right.
G is C. Well, it turns it into the function xf. What happens when you evaluate that function at y? You get f of x inverse y. Okay, right. So the structure of CG, the representation theoretic structure of CG, is really nice. It encodes all of the representation theory of the group, because every era appears in there. And I just wanted to note that, you know, this map that takes you from the group basis to the representation basis is exactly the Fourier transform. So if G were a finite cyclic group, excuse me, then these representations would be characters, and this map would just be the discrete Fourier transform. Okay, so what happens if we build a TLFT with group algebras? Okay, so here's the three tensor and the two tensor that we're going to use. There's nothing fancy here. So if you take the tensor product of three group elements, if the product is the identity of the group, you assign.
My memory is a bit hazy. Is that the regular representation? CID?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's the left regular representation. And if you had x multiply y on the right. The two tensor is just this, just maps one into this average. But I mean, I think the more natural way to think about it is that this M sub AD super C operator is group multiplication. Okay, so it really says take the two group elements A and B and put their product into C. Of course, it's linearized version of that because it's an operator on CG, it's a tensor. Okay, so what happens if we do this? Okay. So we pick a surface without boundary, let's say. S, we pick a group G, take a triangulation of S, we decorate it with the tensors of G that I just described, and we contract the whole thing to get a number in C. So first of all, let's just check. While we'll get a number in C, it's just because S has no boundary. So the triangulation will have no boundary, so the tensor network won't have any loose edges. Everything will be connected together. So the whole tensor network will just contract the same. Okay, so what do you get? So Snyder, so Noah Snyder, he was a grad student last year, he still is, showed that the quantity you get is the sum over all IREPs of the group of the dimension of the IREP to the Euler characteristic of the surface. And the Euler characteristic is just 2 minus 2 times the genus. But he also proved you get this. You also get the size of the group to the Euler characteristic minus 1 times the number of homomorphisms from the fundamental group of S into the group. So this equality that's written down here is called Mednick's equality. It's been known for 30 or 40 years for algebraic topologists, but all the previous proofs have been sort of ugly and messy and complicated. So what Snyder's insight was that he could prove this equality by taking the two-dimensional lattice field theory corresponding to the group and the surface, and then just computing the contraction in the group basis to get this result, and in the Fourier basis to get this result. So those two have to be equal. And so that was his proof. Okay, so I promised that all this would have something to do with quantum computation, and this theorem of Arad and Landau from last year is, heavily paraphrased here, is the basic idea of what this has to do with quantum computation. So they proved that quantum computers can approximate the value of tensor networks efficiently. But there's a few catches to this. So first of all, the approximation is additive. So that's not so good. The approximation scale might actually be so large that the output is useless. And it's not always easy to tell how bad the scale is. You have to have some kind of external measure of what the scale is. Some, you know, just by designing the algorithm, it's not clear what the scale will be. However, this is still non-trivial because they actually showed that this is actually a universal problem. So there are definitely some tensor networks that quantum computers can't track efficiently where that's, you know, not a trivial problem. The issue is when you have something in some tensor network in your hand that you want to contract, you know, it's not clear if you have an algorithm for it, it's not clear if this does something interesting or not.
So how are these tensors specified?
So let me talk about the algorithm and then maybe that will be clear. So they're specified in a particular basis. So they're specified as arrays of complex numbers. So what's the basic idea?
The question is, in which case shouldn't it be just doable using linear, just direct contraction?
What's an exponential size sum?
But it's specified explicitly. Oh, sorry, okay, so the dimension of each of the vector spaces need not be 2, for example.
Yeah, no.
It's not constant, okay.
So in general, if you just try to compute it using the description that I gave earlier, you would get an exponential sign.
Sorry.
You would get, yes.
This is just a statement that you can speed up the computation using a quantum computer, right?
Right, yes. I mean, you can compute it in exponential time by just doing what I said earlier, by summing over all the possible labelings, of which there are exponentially many.
But if these tensors are specified explicitly, then you're already using, if the dimension of each vector Hilbert space is whatever, you have to really, is D, you have to specify basically all the components, right?
Right.
So.
But there's not exponentially many of them. There's just linearly many components, or less.
Right, there's an exponentially many products, but linearly many entries.
For a matrix, for example, mm-hmm. right, which is a tensor, mm-hmm. The dimensions, the order of the matrix, right? So there are 2 indices, each index with dimension d, then you have to specify d squared complex numbers,
right?
And then if you have 2 such matrices and you multiply them, right, you take the complexity of it, which is a tensor contraction, is still polynomial in D, which was,
Right. Because you're multiplying a constant number.
The number of operations would be polynomial in D, D cubed or something for the simplest algorithm, right? And the numbers, the size of the tensor, just to write it down, is d squared complex numbers.
Right.
So it's all efficient, right? It's
right.
In fact, classically efficient.
Right.
So I'm thinking, the way I actually heard about this result is, so the way I was thinking about it is if you had unitaries, which were implicitly that were actually local. So they were not on, so they were on, let's say, 2, each with maybe at most 4 indices,
right?
So 2x2 unitaries in usual language.
Okay.
And you had a circuit composed of these unitaries, then clearly, you get all of quantum computation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and quantum computers, it's sort of simulating the circuit is complete for quantum computation, and
right.
and that's what we do naturally, right?
Right.
but it's sort of, okay, so what am I trying to say?
So, I mean, this is sort of, I mean, the idea here is similar. The only sort of, the only complication is that you have to deal with linear things rather than just unitary things. So, I mean, it really is, I mean, their algorithm really is, you know, using this trick to show how to simulate a linear operator using unitary operators and then just laying out the network like a circuit.
Okay, so now I actually understand where my what my question was about, because I think it's again a similar situation where, you know, you have these tensors only on a constant number of indices, and then you have, you know, your real space is really, I mean, and then you know, its identity on everything else, right? And
right.
Okay.
Yes.
So in that case, it's sort of a non-trivial thing to actually contract.
Can
you go back one side?
Yes.
So when you want to compute these things like the square root of 1 minus t squared, I mean, what is the complexity of the end of things?
I don't know. I mean, so if you do the singular value decomposition of this, then this
to do the singular value decomposition, that already takes time, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm making that classically important. And then what you get is, well, so first of all, right, so one thing you have to worry about is the operator norm of the thing. So what you do is you rescale by the operator norm to get an operator norm 1 operator. Then you do the singular value decomposition, so now you have a unitary, that's fine. And then here you have something diagonal with eigenvalues between 0 and 1, I guess. And so U and V are clear, but here's how you do D, basically. So this is how you turn D into a unitary operator. Check
this thing. Yeah, so, okay, rather than confusing related to what, I mean, the efficiently work in the dimension of the hero spaces. But, I mean, if L can be efficiently described,
approximately,
like, for example, if there is some sparse near grid or whatever, then you can implement. You can do some tricks like this and actually implement U, D, and V efficiently. I mean, well, probably we can take out this, but.
Well, I mean, in some cases.
Efficiently in polylog D.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
But in general, you don't know that that's true. Right? I mean,
okay.
If you just handed some linear operator, you don't know. I mean, sort of the best thing you can do in general is just polynomial in dimension. But. Okay,
what is the complexity then with the classical algorithm? It's also. Officially in matrix multiplication.
We should go on to say 5 minutes left. Okay, so they lay the network out like a circuit once they have this trick for approximating linear operators with unitary ones. So they lay it out like a circuit, so one tensor at a time. And then, you know, basically, sort of like for this example, you can think about this as a map from V to V tensor V. So it's some, you know, rectangular matrix. You can pad it with zeros, and then, you know, use this trick to simulate it. And, you know, the downside is that each time you do this, we pay an approximation scale like the operator norm. Okay, so this leads to, you know, a guess at a quantum algorithm for topological lattice field theories. So your input is a triangulation in a group. Your output will be an approximation of this quantity. So what you do, you decorate the triangulation with your tensors, you contract the resulting network, and you output the results. So I'm just rushing now to get through the rest of this. So let me just give you sort of the good news and the bad news. So like you were saying, in this particular case, you can implement these tensors in polylog time because this is multiplication on a group, so you're using like the Fourier transform control multiplication. So this really would be, you know, a speed up, at least in that particular part of the implementation. The other piece of good news, well, first, the basic strategy applies to the 3D case, and that's what we really care about, because that's where computing free manifold invariance is hard. So the 3D case involving much harder math used to be bad news, but I decided to move it up to good news. I do think it's good news. Right, so bad news, there's an easy classical algorithm for computing Euler characteristics, so you know, we can't just, we're not going to get a speed up if we just use this to approximate chi of s.
So, I mean, the tensors in this case are only with positive non-negative entries, right?
They're unitary, they're positive non-negative entries. Non-negative entries, really? Multiplication operators and...
What are the tensors, what do they look like?
Well, they look like the multiplication operator on the proofs. Right, so again, the speed of the algorithm depends on the quality of the triangulation, but that's sort of something we have no control over. And you can actually work out that sort of the obvious implementation of just assigning the tensors that I described to you leads to a bad approximation scale. There's this question of how you can rescale things, and if there are sort of better ways of contracting the network, or better orders of contracting the network, that can give you a better algorithm. And I have 2 minutes to talk about 3D TLFTs. So in the three-dimensional case, you're going to break up your three-manifold into tetrahedra rather than triangles. And so the question is, what tensors should you assign to the tetrahedra? So it turns out that the right thing to do is to glue along edges in this case. So we need a sixth tensor for every tetrahedron. And the right sixth tensor comes from the representation theory of SU2 and some of its quantum variants. So how does this work? Well, basically, it works like this. Let's suppose that A, B, and C are ERECs of SU2. And let's say K is also an ERECs of SU2. So there are two ways that you can get a copy of K appearing in A tensor B tensor C. It could be that some I appears in A tensor B, so that I tensor C gives you K, or it's so that K appears in I tensor C. Or alternatively, there could be a J appearing in B tensor C, so that A tensor J gives you K. So Schur's lemma tells you that any gene variant map, and this is certainly gene variants, from an ERECT to itself is just scalar multiplication. So this whole diagram just corresponds to some complex number. And this is called the 6J symbol. The inputs for this tensor are 6 ERECT labels, so A, B, C, I, J, K, and the output is the complex number which corresponds to this map. And so this Biedenhaar and Elliott identity tells you that these 6J symbols satisfy the 3D inputs. So we're doing the same kind of sort of thing that we did in the 2D case, except the objects that we're working with are a little bit more complicated. Okay, so basically you can try to follow the same kind of strategy with three manifolds as you did before, label the edges with representation names, assign a 6J symbol to every tetrahedron, but then you run into some complications, like SU2 has infinitely many ERECTs. But you can fix that. You also run into this problem with hinge tensors, because many tetrahedra could be incident in a single edge. So you need kind of tensors that can take an arbitrary number of inputs. So anyway, the punchline is the situation is more complicated, but you can still work out what the result is, and the result is that you're a year of three-manifold invariant majority, three-dimensional TLFT. And so I'll just leave it as a question if there's an efficient quantum algorithm for doing that, maybe with this strategy we will see.
So questions?
So just to understand the problem you're trying to solve, it's that you're given a surface, an orientable surface, I guess, and a group, and you'd like to calculate this quantity, which is that summation over ERECTs, right?
Right.
So you do have some freedom in the choice of triangulation of the surface.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of think about it in a lot of different ways. I guess the fact that there's an efficient classical algorithm for the Euler characteristic kind of makes it, it doesn't make it worth it to try to treat the triangulation as an input and the characteristic as the output. But maybe there's something else you can do. I mean, maybe, well, first of all, you can use an exponentially large group, so maybe that can be something. Maybe you can select triangulations yourself that you want to input so that you get some quantity out. maybe the group will vary. Maybe the group is presented using some oracles. So I mean, there's a lot of questions you can ask. But I mean, I think, you know, the real question, the really interesting part is a three-dimensional piece.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have sort of a real problem. You want to call it an application, a real application of mind, just to calculate these.
And so this fundamental group, I actually, which is pi 1 of S, right? Is that easy to compute, given for a surface?
It's impossible to compute.
I'm sorry?
It's impossible. Well, I mean, quote unquote, impossible.
Okay.
It's not literally impossible. It's one of these insoluble problems, you know, where an algorithm that will compute pi 1 of G given presentation of G in terms of generators and relations, which is how it would come to you from the triangle.
You mean it's
sorry, I said it wrong.
It's inefficient, not uncomputable.
Well, it's one of these insoluble problems, like the Hodling problem.
Okay, so it is uncomputable.
There's something called the word problem for a group.
But that's for an infinite group, right? I mean, these are finite groups.
Not necessarily.
Well, if you're
one of a surface is not in general a finite group.
Oh, I see, right. No, in fact, it's between them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for a surface of genus G, you know exactly what it is. It's generated by...
Oh, sorry, in two dimensions. I was sorry, in three dimensions.
Yeah, in higher dimensions,
it's insoluble.
No, your fundamental group is hard, but if you know, I mean, you can compute the genus efficiently. It's like, well, the older characteristic is like vertices minus edges plus faces.
Right.
So you can compute that classically very easily. But then once you know the genus, you know what the fundamental group is. It's like,
right. I was thinking of three dimensions when I said that. So, I mean, that's a famous result that you can't class, quote unquote, you might see the statement, you cannot classify the three manifolds. And my understanding of it is that it's based on, it reduces to this fact of not being able to solve the word problems for groups.
I think that's true.
And because if you could classify the three manifolds, you would know in particular pi 1 is a three manifold. But pi 1, in the three-dimensional case, you'll just have some generators and relations points. But you won't, given another triangulation, you won't be able to, you'll have different generators and different relations. And you won't be able to know whether you have the same group in the end or not.
Yeah, I think that's...
But you might still be able to calculate, for finite key, you might still be able to calculate the homomorphism.
Yeah. I mean, it's only, when I say insoluble, that was a kind of...
No, I mean...
It's not really insoluble. You might be able to compute what pi 1 is in any given case, but there's no...
Yeah, of course.
There's no algorithm for it. Universally computing.
But there might still be an algorithm for universally computing the homomorphism to a finite group, right?
Oh,
I
mean, yes.
So, but this statement is not true if you plug in, or at least I don't know if it's true if you plug in some higher-dimensional manifold.
Here's an algorithm, right?
This gives the cardinality of, this absolutely.
Well, this just gives the cardinality, the size,
cardinality.
The number. And it also only is true for surfaces.
I see. So your real quantity of interest is the left-hand side of this equation.
Yeah,
right. But if we go to three,
assuming you know, you know things like the size.
Yeah, sorry, but is it that equation is only for...
Only 15. And if you could do three-dimensional, you're doing three-dimensional quantum gravity or some version of three-dimensional quantum gravity.
Yeah, but I mean, in three dimensions, this is not going to be the result of.
No, I know, but if you could efficiently simulate the corresponding tensor networks in three dimensions, that would be some version of doing the path integral of quantum gravity.
Yes, I guess so. I mean,
there's a so-called Regé-Poisson. I don't remember the exact relation, but there's a so-called Regé-Poisson.
The Regé-Poisson is
theory, which I think is essentially, if not literally exactly, the same thing.
The Regé-Poisson of TQFT is, I think, the same thing.
They might not have replaced it with SU2Q or something, but you would have a regularization of three-dimensional.
Turan and Vera replaced it with SUQ because the problem with from Zyler and Reggie was this infinite sum that may not convert.
Right, so you, I
the
guess...
The infinite sum was over your absolute.
Right, so you have some sort of regularization of three dimensions. But, I mean, I'm just saying people studied this exact structure.
Oh, yeah.
For example, Laurent studied this structure in connection with quantum gravity. So it'd be quite interesting if you had an efficient... Did you say you have to speed up for three dimensions, too? I see. If, oh, I see.
It would be very nice.
It would be very, if you did.
I wouldn't be talking about the two-dimensional case most of the talk if I did.
And so, yeah, probably, I mean, if there any other question, if not, we can.
Yeah. Do you know if calculating the top polynomial can be reduced to test the number of poles?
So it looks
I
a lot
know,
like,
I don't remember how, but
it looks a lot like the top polynomial approximation of the
yeah. If you look at the Urad and Landau paper, they
so the fact that they can only do it for planar graphs and the fact that this only works for two-dimensional surfaces, as far as we know.
I'm not sure that those two are related.
Any more questions? Then we can thank Maria again.